HW Media.
Hey, we've got a sponsor you're going to want to check out. There's a fun and challenging murder mystery game called June's Journey. This search for hidden objects will awaken your inner sleuth and project you into a thrilling adventure set in the heart of the Roaring Twenties. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor, Avast, for supporting the Bureau. Avast's new all-in-one solution, Avast One, helps you take control of your safety and privacy online through a range of features. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. Now back to the podcast. I'm Frank Figluzzi, former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence. Join me on a journey to explore our nation's security, the forces that threaten it, and the people who preserve it. Let's talk with insiders in and around the intelligence community, law enforcement, and the military, including, of course, the FBI. They'll take us deep into their stories, their mission, and their lives as we go behind and beyond the Bureau.
You're not always the most popular person in the room.
Shut up and do what the president asked you to do.
In Cuba, of all places.
He blew up at me several times.
You take a cartel leader out and there's another one to replace them.
Ukraine has not yet perished.
Should we be concerned about an accident?
Is he going to use nuclear weapons? I doubt it.
The notion of a face-saving scenario for Putin is very hard to envision at this point.
Mother Russia wants her property back.
I view Putin's actions as terrorism.
This war is explained by one factor. That's it. It's Putin.
I love it when we've got just the right guest at just the right moment in time. And that's true for this episode of The Bureau. General Barry McCaffrey served in the United States Army for 32 years. When he retired in 1996, he was the most decorated general serving in the United States Army, having been awarded 3 Purple Heart medals for wounds received in combat, 2 Distinguished Service Crosses, the nation's second highest award for valor, and 2 Silver Stars for valor. He served overseas for more than 12 years and 4 combat tours with the 82nd Airborne Division, the Vietnamese Airborne Division, and the 1st Cavalry Division, as well as the 24th Mechanized Infantry Division. For 5 years after leaving the military, General McCaffrey served as the director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. And upon leaving government service, he served as the Bradley Distinguished Professor of International Security Studies and an adjunct professor at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Now, we all know him for his military analysis on NBC and MSNBC, and particularly regarding the battle for Ukraine. He's our guest today. Barry, thanks for joining us.
Very good to be with you, Frank.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you. So, you know, I've learned and we talked about how over the life of this podcast, I've understood our listeners to really appreciate the stories of our guests' personal journey, what got them to where they are and lessons learned along the way. So let's talk about a young Barry McCaffrey who makes his way to the United States Military Academy at West Point. How does that even happened for you, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, well, look, I was an Army brat. My dad was West Point class of 39, a poor boy who couldn't get to college any other way, got an appointment to West Point, spent a better part of 9 years in combat in 3 wars, wonderful, very devout Irish Catholic, Boston, superb athlete. And so, you know, I was living in Paris at the time, had early admission to Johns Hopkins. And, you know, at the last minute, I said to myself, I want to go to West Point. So I had a wonderful year at Phillips Andover, an incredibly positive experience for me, and then was fortunate to get an appointment to West Point at age 17 and spent 4 years there and then out into the Army. in 1964, I graduated, right? Just before the Vietnam thing went critical on us.
Indeed, indeed it did. And just give us a snapshot of your service during the Vietnam era.
Well, I had three combat tours. The first of the 82nd Airborne was actually an intervention in the Dominican Republic, you know, a Cuban-inspired rebellion. We got deployed down there. And then I had two follow-on tours in Vietnam. One of them was extremely unusual. I was an advisor as a lieutenant and a captain to the Vietnamese Airborne Division. So I was in a parachute infantry battalion as a really not an advisor. I mean, what did I know? The battalion commander had been in combat for 15 years. So we were really there to provide U.S. fire support, U.S. Logistics support, very intense combat, huge casualties. The Army sent me to a year of training before I went there. Incredible. Spoke Vietnamese probably as well as I did Spanish. Mm. And then the final tour was a tour as a rifle company commander in the 1st Cavalry Division in 68-69, where again I got wounded. Had most of my left arm shot off by a machine gun at close range. Tremendous, you know, high-intensity combat. Bunch of 19-year-old drafty boys who I loved. The first sergeant and I were the only two people in the company over the age of 25. He was a Korean War veteran, age 35, who'd been badly wounded in that same company in the Korean War, B Company, 2nd of the 7th Cavalry. So just a lot of time either in combat or in recovery in military hospitals or Navy hospitals or Air Force hospitals.
Yeah, I'm always amazed by stories of our troops who are wounded in combat, yet return to the fight. Do I have this right that you've earned the Purple Heart three times?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I got wounded twice in the Vietnamese Airborne Division, and then again as a company commander in the 1st Cavalry Division.
Yeah, the sacrifice is astounding, and I can't thank you enough for your service to the nation, which continues to this day, even educating us as we speak on cable television as to what's going on around the world. The West Point experience is kind of singularly unique, but you actually experienced it twice. And by that, I mean, much later in your career, you returned to West Point as a professor. Tell us what that was like.
Well, you know, I came out of the Walter Reed after extended stay, and the Army was good enough to put me in graduate school for a couple of years in political science at American University. And we had a pretty well-organized system to get captains teaching at West Point, various departments. So I went up to West Point and taught American government, comparative politics, economics, and national security as a young guy for 3 years. You know, they always tell people, if you want to learn something, try teaching it.
Sure, and, that's true.
So to this day, I always tell people that I have an advantage over most Americans about understanding the economy, that having taught the subject, I'm confident I don't understand how the economy works. And then later on, when I left the Clinton administration, after 32 years in the military, I got an offer to go back as a Bradley National Security Professor, civilian chair funded by a foundation, and went up there and taught essentially for another 11 semesters, which was really a joy. 20, 25 kids culled out of 300 or 400 applicants. And my dad used to be outraged at me. I told him I was going to teach a bunch of 20-year-olds at the same level as a National Defense University to lieutenant colonels. And these young people were so ferociously intelligent, and they could write, which is almost nobody in America can write a paragraph anymore. They were just beautiful kids. And so, you know, I'd warn my guest speakers, be prepared. These young people are more intelligent than you and I are, but they have no idea of what questions they shouldn't ask. I mean, if you're an Air Force four-star general lecturing the class, they might ask you why we have so many planes. You know, they're just uninhibited, and so be prepared.
Well, but it also speaks to the right instructors, professors, who who foster an environment where no question is off the table, right? And I think we're living in an environment, and even as we speak, there's discussion of how, you know, Putin's advisors and military are fearful of telling him the truth. You know, if your students can't ask questions, then you're failing as a professor. So it says something about you as well, that they felt free to ask those questions. There's another time in your life, Barry, that we've discussed where, you know, you were the one asking the questions unfiltered. And that was when you returned to various combat theaters as someone who was asking hard questions in the form of consulting, advising, and guiding decision makers. And that fascinates me as well. Tell us about that experience.
Well, yeah, you know, by the way, my final combat tour was actually as a division commander in Desert Storm. So I, having spent 5.5 years in Germany as a battalion executive officer and battalion commander in tank mechanized forces, fortunately, I end up as a division commander of the 24th Infantry Division as it deploys out to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, 7 Army divisions, 2 U.S. Marine divisions, Syrian Egyptians, and then essentially the 30-day air war and the 4-day blitzkrieg we pulled on the Iraqi army. So I had a, you know, variety of combat experiences to include the Desert Storm campaign. Well, when I left, I was, my last military job, I was a theater commander, joint commander for Latin America, then into the Clinton administration for 5 years. Then when I came out teaching at West Point, and I added to that, I would happily accept assignments from joint commanders like the CENTCOM commander or the SACUR in Europe for NATO countries. And I take on assignments pro bono, sponsored by these military commanders to go look at national security issues. And I'd come back and I'd write an unclassified report, put it online, try not and pull punches. And I'd also try and point out the unbelievably competent people I was running into. Battalion commanders, brigade commanders, 2-star generals. And I'd also be critical where I thought that was warranted. So I remember at one point, Secretary Rumsfeld called an unnamed CENTCOM commander and said, "Why in the heck are you allowing McCaffrey into Iraq and Afghanistan?" And he said, "Sir, if we can't have an independent view, critical or supportive of what we're doing, we're lost." The military fosters that kind of an environment, particularly if you're the S3, G3, J3 operations officer. You know, when the general says something, you're supposed to speak up and say, "Sir, I don't think you meant to have this come across this way, but X, Y, and Z." You try and shape in a debate, a dialogue, sometimes sort of heated words to get the right outcome.
Yeah.
Collective decision making. And I was able to be part of that.
Yeah, it's invaluable. And, you know, for any leaders who are even heads of families who are listening to this podcast, you've got to make every effort. It's really hard to build it into your daily life and the way you do business to ask for and contrary opinions, to have a system in place where somebody can give you the ground truth. And so many CEOs of corporations sit up on the top floor of their corporate offices in the corner window office and just never get the ground truth from the rank and file. I'm glad someone like you was doing that. But, you know, as you alluded to, you're not always the most popular person in the room when you're developing the ground truth and delivering what could be news that people don't want to hear about how things are going. What are some examples of that in that experience where you had to tell people this, you know, this isn't going right? You got to be aware of something that you may not understand right now.
Well, you know, I think the other thing is, my dad used to talk about this all the time. He'd say, you know, people are, by and large, the senior leaders you run into in the military, for sure, incredibly well-educated. You know, I was a run-of-the-mill 4-star general, and I had 5.5 years of postgraduate education. So the people you're dealing with, certainly in command, are really sharp, dedicated, honest people. But they get tired, they get hungry, they have a bad number stuck in their head from a briefing 8 years ago. Sometimes they make boneheaded mistakes. But for sure, in almost every case, if there's a collective dialogue debate, if you start in a room with 10 people sitting around the table and say, here's the objective, here's the problem we're trying to solve, and then start with the most junior person in the room and say, what do you think we ought to do? And then proceed around the room until it gets to you. A lot of times, the group has actually hammered out the best of all possible decisions by the time you open your own mouth.
Indeed.
Certainly, you're educated. And the downside, you got to see the downside. You know, Frank, you and I hung around Washington, D.C. off and on for years. I used to be a defender of lobbyists, of all things. And I tell people, a lobbyist in Washington, D.C., first of all, you actually can't buy congressmen, contrary to public expectation. Maybe occasionally you do. The FBI knows the ones you can. But, but normally you go in there and you say, I'm representing the electrical business or the banana growers of America, and here's what we want you to do, here's why we want you to do it, and here's the downside of you supporting our position. And if you go into a congressman's office and you sell him, you flim-flam him on the operation, you'll never get back in there again. So I think that also happens in the executive agencies and to CEOs, that somebody that comes in with a burning ambition to have policy X adopted, you'd better tell the senior guy the downside of what's about to happen.
Indeed. Yeah, I used to. There was a time in my career in FBI management when I felt like I wasn't getting feedback, and I was concerned people just didn't want to give it to me, and I would have supervisory meetings and appoint a devil's advocate. And I basically say, we're not leaving the room until I hear a contrary opinion on what we're about to do from somebody.
Yeah.
That, you know, people were still like, really?
Yeah.
Let's take a time out to talk about safety and security. And today, safety and security has to include cybersecurity. In fact, I say there's two kinds of people when it comes to cybersecurity: those who have been hacked and those who have been hacked but just don't know it yet. Avast is a global leader in cybersecurity for more than 30 years and trusted by over 435 million users. Avast empowers you with digital safety and privacy no matter who you are, where you are, or how you connect. Enjoy the opportunities that come with being connected on your terms. Avast's new all-in-one solution, Avast One, helps you take control of your safety and privacy online through a range of features. You can learn more about Avast One by going to avast.com. What I like most about Avast is its data breach monitoring that enables you to find out if your online accounts have been compromised and whether your passwords need to be changed. I also like the PC speed up. It optimizes the background activity of your apps in order to speed up your PC. Avast prevents over 1.5 billion attacks every month. And with Avast One, you can confidently take control of your online world without worrying about viruses, phishing attacks, ransomware, hacking attempts, and other cyber crimes. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. We've got a fun new sponsor called June's Journey. If you like a good whodunit as much as I do, then you'll love June's Journey. You play the game as June Parker, an amateur detective investigating a series of mysteries full of twists and turns around every corner. We all need a good diversion from our stressful lives right now, and June's Journey is the perfect game for that. With thousands of vivid scenes and new chapters every week, there's always a new case waiting to be cracked. Since you're listening to The Bureau, you know I spent my career solving mysteries. So, of course, I've been playing June's Journey to the point where it's hard to put down. It's casual gameplay that fits in whenever you need to escape. There's a detective, or FBI agent, in all of us. And your inner detective can be found by downloading June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Now back to the podcast. So So, look, the Barry McCaffrey at some point, obviously a longtime military servant of the people, finds himself in Cuba, of all places. Tell us the story of what in the world you're doing in Cuba, who you met and talked to, and how you even got into the country.
Well, you know, a lot of these flashpoints around the globe, if you're in uniform and intelligence unit service or whatever, you followed the issue for years. So I obviously followed Cuba fairly closely, and I've always been fascinated with Latin America anyway. My last military responsibility was a giant Southcom commander. I was responsible for military support and operations throughout the Latin American region, Caribbean, Central America, that sort of thing. And then when I came out of the military, I was a drug policy director. And again, for 5 years, Latin America, drug smuggling routes, Colombia, Peru, poor Ecuador, you name it, they were high on my list of places that I was trying to understand and influence. And by the way, I actually love dealing with Latin America, Mexico, the culture, the language, the people, their political elites are frequently better educated and better looking than our political elites. I kept saying we needed to have better contact with Cuba as a drug policy director. And so they kept reaching out to me. And, I talked to General Powell at the time, Secretary of State, and he said, yeah, go on down there. So I linked up with a group who had, to my mind, sort of an anti-American tone to them. And they had an expedition going to meet Castro. So in I went. And I ended up having 8 or 9 hours separate from the group with Castro and his senior people, his brother, the minister of defense, his translator, interpreter. It was fascinating. And poor old Castro, I'd been coached by several people in the intelligence community and in Congress. And, they said, look, this guy's not used to dealing with other adults. He goes on 8-hour rants and lectures people, and they worship him, and they don't oppose his ideas. So he blew up at me several times during this one on me versus the gang session. Almost nobody else was allowed to say anything, by the way, except for Castro. And he, at one point, he said, why are you interrupting me like this? And why are you making these statements? I said, Mr. President, surely you want me as a friend of Cuba, and the doors are closed, to give you honest feedback on what we're talking about. I mean, there was some just
that's called a rhetorical question when you're posing that to Castro. But these pesky Americans with their freedom of speech issues, and we're right back to giving somebody ground truth when they're not used to to hearing it. Well, this is a first for the podcast. I've never had a guest on that spent over 7 or 8 hours with Fidel Castro. But you mentioned drug policy, and I'd be remiss if we didn't get into the fact that you've served in President Clinton's administration. And I believe at the time, at least, this was a cabinet level position. Do I have this right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you were the director of the Office of National Drug Policy. How did that even come to be? How does the phone call come to you that says, hey, General Caffrey, we have something for you?
Well, the armed forces, 2.1 million men and women globally deployed, are actually all under the command of two civilians. The only ones who can give orders to the armed forces are the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense, no one else. And so those two civilians, Dr. Bill Perry, this genius, this humble man, and President Clinton so they knew all the nine of us as joint commanders. You have a phone, you can pick up the phone and call the guy. And I had run into President Clinton several times. I had tremendous admiration for him. Incredibly hard worker, listens to people, reads the briefing book that's 8 inches thick before you go in the Oval Office. So he wanted me to be the drug policy director. He was in political trouble. It was a year to the reelection campaign. There were several issues on why he wasn't going to get reelected. One of them was a drug issue, and they asked me to. And I said no. And I said, but I wrote him a several-page letter, and here's how to better organize this effort. And here are the names of three people that are superbly qualified to take on responsibility. And Secretary Perry, this lovely man, called me in and said, Barry, he said, I wouldn't do this to my best friend, but I've told the president, you ought to be the drug policy director. And the vice president called me in twice. The president saw me. I told him I really didn't want to do it. And my dad said, shut up and do what the president asked you to do. And so that's how I ended up as a drug policy director.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the most useful five and a half years of my life.
Well, that's saying a lot, Barry, for someone who has had the life experience you've had. Why do you say that? To me, having been on the law enforcement side of drugs and drug enforcement, it's often viewed as just this Sisyphean task. You're rolling the stone up the mountain and back down the mountain, and you take a cartel leader out and there's another one to replace them. Why do you say it was that rewarding an experience?
You know, that's actually a great way to set up that issue, because it is. It's not a victory to be won, a war to be waged. You know, there's 325 million of us. Most of us don't abuse alcohol or use drugs. The country's actually in great shape. But, you know, even today, as we're recording this useful discussion, last year, 101,000 people overdosed dead from illegal drug abuse. And almost 99% died from alcohol abuse. So it's this central issue in American society. That explains a lot. Almost everything you don't like about life can be explained by drug and alcohol abuse. And add in cigarettes, which kill 420,000 people a year, and you've got the single greatest health threat to America, but it dominates criminal discussion. You know, so what I did know a considerable amount about was how to get bills through Congress, how to deal with the media, how the Washington environment worked. And then I got out there and was able to support the people in prevention and education programs, meaning homeroom teachers, coaches, pediatricians, ministers, and then to get involved in the treatment community with these beautiful people who are involved. Unfortunately, you know, let's say there's 20 million of us have a drug and alcohol problem. Maybe 3.5 million of us have access to science-based drug treatment. So there was an area that I made a major effort in, along with research, National Institute of Drug Abuse. And then finally, there was a coordination ability to try and go out to the global community and say, stop saying Colombia or Mexico, that our drug addicts are what's causing your problem. Let's view this as a common challenge that's devastating to our youth, to our working community, to our law enforcement community. And so that's what we did. And we actually made a huge impact, had great cooperation out of Congress, both political parties, and certainly great support out of President Clinton and his cabinet.
Yeah, talk about the metrics for success there while you were leading this. What tangible metrics stand out to you that made a difference?
Well, we measured everything. And you can measure the input function. We got tremendously increased resources from Congress, bipartisan support, to fund research. We put together a multimedia approach to try and communicate, particularly with adolescents. Look, nobody's 30 years old, has your first baby, graduates from law school, and says, I think I'll start using cocaine. That just isn't the way it works. So you get an eighth graders are drug free. By the end of high school, half of them have tried an illegal drug, and a quarter of them are past month drug users. So the centerpiece of any drug control strategy has to be, how can we reduce or delay the exposure of adolescents to illegal drug use? And by that, I mean principally smoking cigarettes, binge drinking beer, and using pot. Get a lot of that behavior and you put yourself statistically in an enormously enhanced likelihood of ending up at age 30, unemployed, HIV positive, with significant mental health problems, living on the street, turning tricks for your food that night. I mean, it's just the misery of drug addiction is palpable. Yeah. And so that's what we said, that's what we got to do. The tough one, I might add, is drug treatment. We have science-based standards. We know how to get people detoxified and get them into sobriety. We know how to deal with relapse prevention, but it costs money and you have to organize institutions that have bright young people working in them. The best thing you can do is make sure your employees and your children don't end up chronically abusing drugs.
Yeah, yeah. It's a devastating impact on families, individuals, our economy, et cetera, as you said. And you almost can't intervene early enough. You almost can't get in front of kids too early. And yet, of course, we have states talking about legalizing or decriminalizing hallucinogenics. It's almost it's a fatalistic, terrible. Yeah, it's almost kind of a we give up attitude, which I'm certainly
well,
not.
You know, something sort of baked into our society that we encountered was there's an old canard that says, look, people have to reach rock bottom until they're on the street, disgraced by their own behavior. The stigma is incredible. And then we can intervene. But that's not the case. So, you know, if it's your high school age daughter, if it's your mother abusing opioids, the time to intervene in a collective approach to dealing with the problem is now, not after they're on their 10th felony arrest.
Agreed. Let's move on to a challenge of another kind that's being waged across the globe, and that's the battle for Ukraine. You're on covering this. I am to some extent, certainly not to the extent you are. I want to ask you about the media's coverage of the Ukraine-Russia conflict and what they're getting right, what they may not be getting right. And then let's segue that right into what's going on in Putin's head and where you see this playing out.
Well, it's an enormous tragedy of just galactic importance, you know. Here's this giant country, giant population, 44 million people, sovereign nation, a sort of a fragile democracy, no question, corruption, political infighting, the obvious division between the Russian speakers and the Ukrainian speakers. And so, but it was making its way in the world, and it was headed toward the European Union, it was headed toward NATO, it understood, baked into its DNA was oppression by the Russians, the czars. Stalin starved to death millions of them. You know, their national anthem, it starts with, Ukraine has not yet perished. What an insight into a vulnerable, suffering society. And then we get this, this war is explained by one factor. That's it, it's Putin. And it ain't NATO. And it ain't biological warfare labs. There's a lot of utter nonsense that wasn't even explained by the internal divisions inside Ukraine. It's Mr. Putin said, this is part of Russia. It must be integrated back into Mother Russia. I'm going to seize the country by force. And this is the fourth time he has conducted criminal operations against another state, involving mass murder of civilians to force capitulation, and he's gotten away with it. And I think most of us who were following the issue closely, I mean, in and out of Kiev arms control negotiation over the years, and by the way, thank God we got the nuclear weapons out of all the satellite states of the Soviet Union, put them back in Mother Russia, we might have a nuclear war going on now. Mm-hmm. So poor Ukraine said, no, we're not going to do this. Their courage, their commitment, their leadership. There's some of their military leadership, some civilian who stuck on a camouflage uniform, organized his friends and territorial unit, went out to defend their own town. It's utterly magnificent. I hope with European support in particular, U.S. support, and global diplomatic and economic sanctions, I hope these people can keep their freedom. The decision's in the balance. It's not decided either way.
You've got some serious NATO experience in your past. With an increasingly cornered Putin, someone who feels like he's not getting the truth from his closest advisors, can't rely on anyone, increasingly desperate perhaps, What would get NATO involved or the U.S. involved? We've heard, of course, talk of the possible use of biochem weapons, which certainly I would not put past him. What would that response look like? What do you think would get the U.S. or NATO involved in a far bigger way than currently?
Couple observations. The first, the most historically accurate observation of the U.S. and how we go to war are decisions that were completely unpredictable, both to our adversary and internally in our own political system. I mean, every time, go look at it. How do we end up in a civil war? You couldn't get through that decision process the same way in 100 times. World War II, the strike on Pearl Harbor. Poor Mr. Hitler, the murderous thug, declares war on us. Korea, the Secretary of State, makes an inartful comment about Korea's outside our defense envelope. And the North Koreans, with Chinese and support, invade South Korea. Vietnam, you know, the Tonkin Gulf resolution. So one thing Putin ought to be aware of is that even though properly President Biden has said, I don't want the U.S. involved in direct combat operations inside Ukraine, there is a possibility that that's where we go. Some of them, I have publicly argued, if he uses chemical weapons, and by the way, I've dealt with chemical and biological and nuclear weapons my entire life. Chemical weapons are a lousy military option. It doesn't work. If you fire chemicals at the U.S. Army, we've got protective gear, medical antidotes, early warning systems. We can fight in a chemical environment pretty darn well. Misery kills some of us, but we can deal with it. If you use them against civilians living in basements in Kyiv or Kharkiv or Odessa, you're going to kill thousands of people. If he employs chemical weapons, and personally, I hope Secretary Blinken and Lloyd Austin have told the Russians this, I think we'll be in the war. And if we do, I hear a lot of nonsense on TV. Well, if he uses chemical weapons, we'll provide a safe zone near the frontier or a retreat corridor from the town so attacked. If he uses chemical weapons, U.S. air power needs to go after the Russian military in Ukraine, in Belarus, in the Sea of Azov, in the Black Sea, or in Russia, wherever we need to do to take out chemical delivery systems. He'd be in the war. He'd lose most of his military power in Ukraine in a 30-day campaign. Would it widen? Would it go to World War III? Would it escalate vertically into nuclear weapons? I doubt it. I don't know what would happen, but he's in no position to start World War III. For God's sakes, he's got most of his ground combat forces and his air power trying to deal with the Ukraine. Is he going to use nuclear weapons? I doubt it. It's madness. You can't have a nuclear exchange and win. And Putin knows that. Mm-hmm. But there may be other ways we'd get in the war. I think at some point, you know, Mariupol was an example. If he does that to Kyiv, at some point, the Europeans, by the way, the three NATO nations that really count are the UK, France, and the US. The Germans have disarmed. They have almost zero military value. In a couple of 3 years, they'll have military value because they're now, it reminded them what happened in 1945. But I think we're one step short of being pulled into that ground war. The better alternative is give them undivided attention and resource support in the coming 90 days.
Yeah, as we increasingly see attacks in Lviv and attacks getting closer and closer to the Polish border, should we be concerned about an accident, something being lobbed over the border into Poland? And what would that response look like? When we're hearing word that they're not even picking up the phone these days when Washington calls Moscow, how do we de-escalate an accident that results in a strike in Poland?
Well, you know, it's a significant danger, there's no question about it. And I assume that there will be an accident. If the Russians actually approach there's four NATO nations bordering on Ukraine. So if the fighting continued right up to the border, there's going to be cross-border incidents involving air power, cruise missiles. There already has been. One of them got fired up and landed in Poland. Nobody wanted to talk about it, but I think the bigger problem is, what is Mr. Putin know? What are his generals telling him? I listened to former Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Khosrov, who I've actually dealt with. He's a brilliant man. He's hiding in New York under, I'm sure, FBI protection right now. Just interviewed on MSNBC. A lovely, lovely person who grew up in the Stalin era. So, and when I was negotiating with the Russians, a lot of these guys trusted us far more than their own senior political leadership. And Kosovo, I think it was, made the comment, he said, these generals, when they walk in the room, are more likely to kill him than tell him the truth. So he wasn't trying to accentuate to kill him. He was saying it's perilous to the extreme to go in there and tell him, hey, this, we're in a mess. We lost operational control of a 250,000-man military operation. At battalion level, we're being outfought by Ukrainian civilians armed with rapidly with assault rifles and U.S. smart munitions. I think it's worth being extremely concerned. There is zero chance that Putin's going to say, let's back out of there. We'll tell him all along we only wanted the Donbass, the land bridge, the Crimea. I think he knows he has to get Odessa. But even then, he's on record in public too many times saying Mother Russia wants her property back. So I don't think he can back out of there. So what I sort of hope is these brave Ukrainians finally have the generals work up the courage to either remove him from office or go in there and tell him, sir, we quit. We can't do this.
Wow. Yeah, it's the notion of a face-saving scenario for Putin is very hard to envision at this point.
By the way, comment on that. You know, I think part of the problem is a lot of discussion on, you know, how do we find an off-ramp and face-saving? And yet, I think it's vitally important. Conflict resolution, the end of a war, is the most dangerous part of a war. We cannot tolerate Putin ending this war and saying, I won. He must be humiliated. The sanctions must stay in place. He must be a pariah. And that's going to be tough for the U.S. and NATO to organize, but that's important. We can't say, okay, we're going to give you a third of Ukraine, we meaning the Europeans and the U.S. We've got to make sure that he ends up exposed for what he is, a criminal.
That may be the biggest takeaway I have from our discussion today, Barry, and I've got several, but I think you've just helped me to refine and reshape the way I speak about this, because you're right. The traditional notions of negotiation and compromise do not apply to a terrorist. And through my law enforcement and intelligence lens, I view Putin's actions as terrorism. He certainly meets the legal definition of trying to intimidate, coerce through force a civilian population for political means. He's not necessarily attacking the United States, but otherwise he is, in my mind, a terrorist. And giving a terrorist a face-saving solution is not the way to go. So thank you for that reminder. I want to close with a discussion of how Biden is doing in this realm. You've advised presidents before. You've been in combat before and led troops. You referenced the countries that count really in NATO. You also made reference to Germany. How's Biden doing by your measure in regards to Ukraine, Russia?
Well as he could possibly do. You know, notwithstanding verbal gaffes in this kind of discussion, he's an experienced, decent man. He's got a kind heart. He's got integrity. Fortunately, I think overwhelmingly, his cabinet officers tend to be technocrats with high IQs and lots of experience. I mean, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State, CIA Director Burns, these are really knowledgeable, stable people. And their success in bringing NATO together has been simply phenomenal. Trump almost destroyed our alliances globally, and Biden and his team have put them back together. So I think he ought to feel proud of the collective team effort, and mostly on the Ukraine issue, on national security issues. There's a tendency for the Republicans to come aboard and try and support sensible U.S. foreign and national security policy. So, I mean, thank God for all that.
Indeed. Indeed. We've seen a remarkable kind of unanimity amongst the NATO nations. And as we've talked about previously, 30 countries getting their act together collectively is pretty astounding. On that positive note, we're going to thank you not only for carving out this time with us today in what I know is an incredibly busy schedule, and for your body of work in serving the nation, Barry. We're grateful. We may come back to you as things develop, but thanks for spending time with us.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Thanks for joining our discussion with General McCaffrey, a man who epitomizes service to the nation. You can learn more about Barry at his website, www.mccaffreyassociates.com. Next time, we'll have another fascinating guest as we go beyond the Bureau with Frank Figlusi.
The Bureau is written by Frank Figlusi and executive produced by Allison Gill, with sound design and editing by Molly Hockey, with podcast art design by Johanna Coxeter. Music for The Bureau is written and composed by Peter Rydberg. The Bureau is a proud member of MSW Media Network, a collection of independent creator-owned podcasts focused on news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.